Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Moving Spotlight Podcast. I'm your host, John Ruby. I'm here with my co-host,
Corbin Coyle. Hey, everybody.
He's gunning for that main host
title. Oh, I want to get it. I know you are, Corbin. I want it.
I always have someone else test my tea before I drink it, just to make sure. Just and then I give it 5-10 minutes.
So I can't do the tea routine anymore.
No, the tea boys have been building up my arsenic so I can take a little bit every day.
Yeah. You're one step ahead of me all the time.
Try something else, Corbin. Topic today. This is. I have to think about this one a little bit. What is a prediction about the future that you have?
Oh, interesting.
It's broad.
Yeah. The first thing that popped in my mind, as you know, I'm a big old nerd. So like I've seen like there's certain like games or like Blade Runner-esque sort of things where like I like that kind of dark macabre kind of future. And I think like cybernetic like enhancements will kind of be a thing. So like if you like upgrade your arm or your eyes or like whatever. I think we already kind of are doing that, obviously, when it comes to like sort of like surgeries, like kind of improving your nose or like where your shape of your jaw or whatever. I think it will get to a point where we might have to be able to like have mechanical things showing. And I think that'd be interesting. I'm hopeful that that'd be kind of cool, but it is kind of often seen as like a very negative thing in the future. But yeah,
that's... You think you'd be like someone would get like an arm that's like super strong and powerful
yes.
like that or something?
Yeah,
so think,
like something you could jump higher, you know, or something with like like bionic legs or something, you know. So, but yeah, that's kind of where I think it would kind of switch. I just don't know how much we'd accept seeing somebody half robot, you know. And does that become is there like a tipping point? Is it kind of like tattoos, where if like you get X amount, that does it become kind of like, I don't know, problematic? It's not the right word, but like, does it become more visually kind of jarring, or what does that look like? But yeah,
not the same, but when I see the little robots delivering food, have you ever seen those little things? It looks like a little R2-D2. For some reason, I'm always like, oh, look at that thing. I'm like, no one better mess with that thing. I feel like it's defenseless. You know, I feel like people are going to knock it over. And I mean, I guess for those things, I'm always like, oh, I know it's different, but I've seen that a couple times.
That's a good point. I've never seen anybody mess. I'm sure they do, but I've yet to see anybody mess with one of those little
guys. They
shouldn't. Yeah, they're so cute. He's got little eyeballs.
A little flag or something. Yeah. I'm always like, how does it know? But it knows.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah. My prediction also has to do with technology. I think in the future, you'll be able to like, you know, put on whatever the any type of goggles. And like, let's say for Christmas, you will be in the room with those people. Like they'll see kind of like a hologram of you, even though you're in a different location.
Yes.
But it'll feel like you're there. You know what I mean? We kind of already have the FaceTime, I guess we're kind of there. But my point is like, I think you'll kind of see almost like a 3D, you'll be kind of projected into the room and you'll be able to look around the room, which I think will be, is actually pretty, pretty cool.
Yeah.
I think that'll be really interesting.
So you're saying, cause I know like the Apple Pros just came out. So like, is it like that where you have a thing over your glasses, or is it something like in the room, it's projecting like John's in my room now?
I think you'll still have some sort of goggles that'll get smaller and lighter and all that stuff. But I do think like then if you're in the place where it's projecting, they're seeing, they don't need the goggles, and like you're kind of projected in is what I think. So one person's wearing those, the other person's kind of projected into the space is kind of what I obviously I think is to be, you know, that's kind of something I see, because I feel like it's the evolution kind of what FaceTime.
Yeah. My prank brain is going off. I feel like you can do a lot of things with that. I feel like you just start popping up at people's places.
That's why they won't release it for them. They won't release
I'm the problem.
It. People like you. Yes. Excellent. Well, I don't know if she's going to have any predictions about the future. This is not why we brought her on, but maybe she does. I'm excited to welcome to the show actor and writer Alexandra Wright. Hello, Alex.
Hey, y'all. How's it going?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. I like y'all's predictions. I might have to just think of a few or think of something as we talk to share, but I think that y'all's predictions are... I always get scared when I think about Black Mirror type stuff. Did you ever watch that show?
Yes, of course. Yes,
yeah,
yes.
The Black Mirror kind of future predicted. I think that's where my brain goes. It gets a little dark. So I'll have to think about some future predictions that aren't quite so scary.
That one Black Mirror where it was like you get like social score points, right?
Yes.
And then you can also lose those points.
That's exactly where my brain goes first, is to that episode, which is terrifying. But I can see it.
I think there is this balance. Yeah, trying to figure that out. So, well, good. Well, if you think of anything, excellent. Please.
I will. But, no pressure.
No, there's not. Alex, tell us a bit about your an actor. Tell us a little bit about your acting journey, kind of how you started out and you know, what you're interested in acting and, you know, how you found it.
Sure. God, where to start? So I'm not from California. I'm from a really small town in Mississippi, a farming community. And, you know, no one in my family is involved in the industry. And I just kind of grew up like dancing on the fireplace and, you know, making my family sit and watch me. I don't know how I learned the word monologue. There's a video of me when I'm like three. And my aunt is like, oh, is she going to sing for us? And I was like, I'm going to do a monologue. And I don't know where I got that word from or how I learned that. But so it was always kind of something that was in my blood. And then, though, again, don't know how, because neither of my parents were actors. My mother was a very dramatic model. So maybe I got it from her. Who knows? And then when my mom moved my sister and me to Texas, our accents were so thick that our teachers couldn't understand us. And so my mom put us in singing lessons, thinking that that might help with speech. And then we saw like a production of Peter Pan at the local playhouse in San Antonio. And we were like, that's what we want to do. And so we, with our singing coach, learned some songs and auditioned for The Wizard of Oz at the local playhouse. And that kind of started it. And I think my parents hoped that it would be something I would maybe grow out of. And it just stuck. I moved out here when I was 18. I went to school out here. My parents probably thought I was crazy. I'd never been to California. And I was like, I'm just going to go. And It's like that beautiful naivete that only a teenager has, where it's like, I'm going to go do this thing. And studied it in undergrad and studied it in grad. I've always been really interested in technique and theory. And yeah, started doing a lot of theater initially. Could not get a TV audition to like save my life. I think everyone just saw Shakespeare on my resume and was like, she's going to be boring and too loud or something.
too many doths protests.
Yeah, that's a lot. Yeah. And she's constantly like stabbing herself and dying. Y'all know what it's like. It's just the grind of, you know, you're slowly planting seeds and hoping they pay off down the road. And building a life, and all of a sudden you kind of turn around and you're like, oh, actually, I'm doing it. I'm doing the thing. And, you know, little me on the fireplace would be so happy to know that I'm doing the thing. But yeah, I don't know if that answers your question. Yeah. That's been a journey.
Yeah. When you first got here, were there any like classes, or if you were to go back and tell your younger self, like, are there any classes or types of techniques you think people should start when they kind of come out to like LA and do acting? Or, I mean, it's just, that's, I know it's a broad question, but it's such a, people always wonder that, you know, like, how do I get into it? Like, it's like really just trying anything. But
yeah, that's a good question. I'm a big believer, and I'm sure there's going to be people who are going to hear this and just yell at their podcast app. I'm a big believer in staying away from any studio that teaches just one technique. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of those in LA, and they can kind of become a little cult-like, mm-hmm. where it's like, we teach this technique and only this technique. And I think that there's a lot of danger in that, because I think as actors, we are artists, and part of our artistic journey that's never ending is going, what is working for me in this moment, in this time of my life with this character? Mm-hmm. And my fear is that with some of those classes, and I hear it a lot from my own students, I teach at UCLA, I hear it from them, is I went and I took this class and that technique didn't work for me and I think I'm doing it wrong. And it's like, mm-hmm. no, you're not doing it wrong. Mm-hmm. There are as many different techniques as there are people in this world. So I think getting into a scene study class, just like Cameron Watson. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I can name drop Cameron mm-hmm. Watson.
Of course, we had him on the podcast, yeah. Alex. So yeah, you can drop it.
I adore him. Yeah, Cameron Watson, I think, is a beautiful example of a great scene study teacher, because he's not sitting there going, here's the 5-step Cameron Watson plan. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all about story, character, empathy, curiosity. I think getting into a scene study class that exalts those ideas versus having a formula, and if you don't follow the formula, you're a bad actor. I think that kind of scene study class, I think if people can find a good movement class or voice class, those are always good basics to have too. But I am a big believer in technique and training, but I think in LA it's, and I'm sure in New York too, it's hard to find. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find that. BGB Studios is another one I really love, mm-hmm. In terms of teaching good technique without teaching a formula, mm-hmm. Or some sort of weird cult-like acting manifesto work. But hey, to each their own. I say all of that, and then to each their own. If praying to a purple praying mantis helps you get there. And also, I think read a lot too. Like, I always tell this people, like, you can go read that technique book, and if it lights you up, then go find the studio to study that. But I think one of the best things that, or the best kind of habits that was instilled in me when I was younger in high school was I had this very amazing, but very rigidly strict acting teacher. And every summer we had to read, even if we had read it the year before, we had to read Boleslavsky, acting the first six lessons. We had to read all of Stanislavsky, all of Uta Hagen, Practical Handbook for the Actor, Larry Moss, Intent to Live. And those are books I still return to. And they always feed me. Mm-hmm. And I think reading is just as good as being in a class. I think you need both, but I think read. Yeah.
I love that, Alex. I always like to have like a, sometimes when I'm doing like a play or something, I'll have the acting book backstage and I'll kind of be reading through it slowly and then thinking about things that resonate that might, I might try, or just even like kind of in a notebook. And I think sometimes people think read and they're like, okay, I got to get to the end of it. And I'm always like, slow down, like do a chapter, think about it, see what you like, don't like, especially like Uta Hagen stuff. You know, there's stuff in there to grab if you want, and then you can apply it or not, you know, but I think if you blaze through an acting book, you're kind of missing the point.
Absolutely.
In my opinion, you know?
Absolutely.
With that, Alex, you know, we're talking about kind of, you know, acting schools and things like that. What about finding community? How did you kind of build / find community coming out to LA, or how would you recommend people do that?
Yeah, I am a social creature. So community is always something that is important to me. I actually created an online community for actors for that reason. Not to plug that, but plug that because I think it's so important. And I always tell my students, I think the reason people quit acting or any career in the arts, it's not because they suddenly don't love it anymore. It's because the lifestyle is so hard to sustain. And part of that is it can be a very lonely and isolating field. And that's kind of ironic, because as actors, we are most of the time social collaborating creatures. We want to be collaborating with people on a project, on a set. But the majority of our days are kind of solo. We're lucky when we get to be on set or in a play or in class. Most of the work is like memorizing sometimes as a solo job, or reading a technique book, or building that character. So I was really fortunate when I moved back here after grad school, because I went to undergrad here, I had a strong community. But then throughout the years, it's really been through theater, through acting class. I now have a group of friends. We call ourselves the witches. We don't do anything witchy. We just support each other in goals. And oftentimes the things we hear are, you know, hey, I know this girl from high school. She just moved out here and she doesn't really have a network of people. And we're like, bring her to the next witch event. Like, I guarantee out of the 40 to 50 women there, she's going to find one person that she jives with. And then they can start to build that relationship, because it can be lonely. And then people want to quit, because they just feel like they're on this very difficult journey solo, and they're not.
Where do you think you kind of learn to do something like that? Because like a lot of people go like, oh, I wish I had a community, and then just kind of sit around. Did your mom, you said that she was like in a dramatic modeling kind of sphere. Like,
dramatic model woman.
Yeah.
It's funny you asked that. I hadn't really thought about it, but yeah, probably. You know, she, again, I grew up in this really tiny town, and somehow still in this like farming community. She created a company called Dixie Wright Models, and it was just a bunch of women in town, and they would get together and awesome. And model, but they weren't necessarily models. I think there was like one young girl who ended up going off to South Korea and actually modeling, but otherwise it was just a bunch of women in town who needed community. So yeah, I hadn't really thought about it, but that probably did come from my mom. I feel very blessed in the sense that I have a fantastic group of girlfriends, and when I'm around them, I feel so full and lit up, and not everyone has that experience. And so it's always fun to be like, oh, y'all are going to get along like a house on fire. Like, y'all have to go, you know, y'all have to meet. I love connecting people like that. And then I think with the acting community I have, it's that same passion, but it's, I'm fortunate in that I've taught at a bunch of different schools. And so I'm able to connect younger artists to each other, because I've taught it, UCLA, Azusa Pacific University, Loyola Marymount University, the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. And then I have private students. So I'm able to go, oh, this person needs someone for their short film and this person's looking for someone for their student film. So I'm fortunate in that I get to do that for younger actors too.
Wait, can we just appreciate, she said, you're going to get along like a house on fire. Mm-hmm. Alex, that's great. I don't even know exactly what that means, but I like that phrase. I've never heard that phrase.
Really?
I love it.
I don't know. Yeah, maybe that's a Southern thing. Get along like a house on fire.
Well, I'm from Wisconsin. That's Midwest. Corbin, you're from California. Yeah. Have you heard get along like a house on fire?
No, I've never heard of it. No, I love it. It's very, very poetic.
Get along. And again, it doesn't really make any sense, but most of our Southern sayings make no sense.
No, but it works. It made sense to me, even though it didn't make sense. Good. I love it. Alex, I want to kind of drill down a little bit since you've, worked in TV and done things like that. Yeah. I just want to ask you kind of about auditioning. You know, there's a lot of self-tape stuff, kind of maybe your thoughts on how self-taping has changed the game, kind of things, you tell actors to do maybe to stand out or, how to kind of get into it and kind of your thoughts on where auditioning is right now. Cause that's a big thing, not going in person for a lot of people.
I know people miss being in the room, and especially I think for folks who have a theater background, we get so much from the audience and we're used to having that feedback, that energy kind of feedback loop. But personally, I love self-taping. I feel like there's such freedom there. The thing that was a big shift for me in terms of mindset and something I try to encourage in my students is think about it like an art project or an exploration. And so just keep the tape running and, don't press stop and start, because there's something about pressing that record button that makes us go, now I'm acting. But if we just keep it going, and what if I enter from this part of the frame, or what if I start like, with my back turned and then turn towards camera, we think there's all these rules for some reason. And it's like, what if I just break all of them? Or what if I have a secret? Or what if I put a scarf on for this one? I don't know. We also seem to have more freedom in terms of how we use the frame and how we use props. Again, we want to be careful with props, but I just think there's so much more freedom, and it can be an art project. It can be an exploration of, choose a theme, loneliness or a state of mind, versus, oh my God, I'm waiting in the waiting room and now I'm going in and it's this job interview. So I love self-taping for that reason. Personally, I think there's so much more artistic freedom available to you.
Yeah. I love that idea of like not hitting, start and stop. And I remember, I think we talked about it on here, but just like, Clint Eastwood doesn't say action and cut, because he used to do like movies with horses and it would like spook the horses. And so he just like gets actors, from what I've heard, rehearsing, and then he just kind of points to the crew and then they start rolling. So it's kind of neat. You're just kind of already kind of in the life of it, kind of like you're saying. So it's like, maybe it's a bad take or whatever, just roll right back into it. And I've also found, you said you do some coaching. I found sometimes when I coach too, I can kind of overtalk something, and sometimes it's nice just to go right back into it. You know what I mean? Like you can kind of talk it to death, and then the actor gets in their head, and it, versus just like, just do it again. Let's just see where, sometimes it kind of shakes it out itself.
Absolutely. Yeah. You get to the end and like go straight back into it. Or sometimes if the scene needs to have a specific build, it's like right where we've ended there, start there.
Yes.
I really find it freeing. I've started to do this thing kind of subconsciously, but then it kind of hit me the other day where if I get the script, I'll spend like the first day writing out my lines, starting to memorize. And then day two, if I have a day two, is more just like letting the character kind of unfold themselves to me as I go throughout my day. And then the day of taping is really just a day of playing, where all of a sudden I'll wake up and I'm like, if I wore that sweater, then that's going to make me feel what if she does feel that way? Yeah. Okay. I'm going to try it with that. And then I have those glasses downstairs, and if I put those on and I take them off in that moment, that's going to be an interesting reveal. Like it's just a day of what if, which is really exciting, because then it's all about really what I want to explore, and not what do I think they want, which I think is such a horrible trap to fall into, and we all do. But if you do all the text analysis stuff first in those first 2 days, then anything that comes out of you in your imagination portion on day three it's going to be in line with the text analysis. You have to trust that, that the text analysis is fueling those artistic impulses that come in day three. So I just feel like I don't, and I guess me personally, I don't feel that as much when I'm in the waiting room and there's other actors there. And all of a sudden I'm going, well, God, she's not wearing the sweater that I'm wearing and I have no makeup on and she looks so pretty. Did I just totally fuck this? Did I just totally screw this up?
Yeah.
So there's just much more freedom. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you feel like your improv training background kind of helps with that a little bit? Because it kind of feels like you're willing to just play and kind of get in there. But some people really, like you mentioned, you need to start the scene where you ended it. And that's sometimes really hard unless you can play off of like the emotion or the audience or whatever is coming towards the end.
Yeah, I think improv is incredibly helpful. I think improv, sometimes I'll talk to people about improv and like it's such a helpful tool for actors and they'll go, I don't really want to do like, I'm not interested in being an improv performer. I'm not interested in comedy. And it's more about just learning how to listen. Mm-hmm. The best way to learn how to listen, I think, and the imagination. Mm-hmm. And saying yes to whatever and trusting those impulses as they come up for you is everything, I think.
Yeah. Alex, why should people study Shakespeare? Because it's so old.
And boring.
So why do you love it or enjoy it? And I'm just curious your thoughts.
Shakespeare is my boyfriend. Actually, here's Cody Jackman. Do you want to say hi to Cody? I know we're recording the podcast right now.
Hi, Cody.
It's John Ruby.
Hi, Cody. How you doing?
Good to see you.
Your ears must have been ringing. We were talking about Shakespeare. So yeah, I know.
As I came upstairs, I just heard Alex go, well, Shakespeare's my boyfriend. And this is a good conversation.
So we have a podcast. We actually should start doing it again called Shake, 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 which was about diverse casting in Shakespeare along with cocktail recipes.
That's great.
Yes.
Yeah, it was great. Fun blend. Yeah. And I mean, the thing I love about Shakespeare, I think technically for actors, it's like lifting weights. It's like if you can do a Shakespeare monologue, then anything else you do that follows is going to be, going to be a mistake. Yeah. But I think that there's something so human about every single one of his plays. There's something so familiar and resonant and universal that, you know, you can read a play or read a script or read a scene or a monologue and be like, I don't really understand that. And then as soon as you do the second read, it like breaks through some like layer of skin in your body. And you're like, oh, I get that a little bit more. And then with each pass, it like just finds a way to get down into your bones, I think more than any other playwright. Cody, do you have something you want to add?
Yeah. I would say this on every single episode of our podcast, and I'd always get so excited and feel like it was new. And Alex would be like, you say that on every single.
No, but this is new for us.
Shakespeare, she knows exactly what is about to come out of my mouth. Shakespeare wrote the human condition so well that any human being can step into any character and it's going to resonate. Because Shakespeare wrote humans, not characters. Mm-hmm. And I think he just has a superpower that I'm not sure we're ever going to get again.
Yeah.
Like there's something that's just magical about the way that he wrote humans.
Yeah. And I think part of that too is the rhythm, the iambic pentameter, that heartbeat. You know, he wrote to the rhythm of the heart. And so when your character's iambic pentameter changes and their heartbeat changes, you feel that shift in you too. So when people are like,
you have to breathe differently
and then you feel what they're feeling. And all of a sudden you feel like such deep empathy for them. It's such an easy way in. I think, you know, I say Shakespeare's like lifting weights. I think the technical side of Shakespeare can be overwhelming for some people, but for me too, not just some people. It can be overwhelming, but once you break through that, it's so easy because it's all there for you, everything you need, and you just have to trust him.
We are in a cult. Shocking. It's so good to see you. Nice to meet you, Corbin.
Good to meet you.
This was our first stop by on the podcast.
I was going to say, episodes. I hope it's a little guest star.
We haven't had it before. I love it. Thank you, Cody. You have to come back. You know, I was just thinking when you were saying that, Alex, I love all of that. And so my son's middle name is Chaplin, and we named him after Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah.
And so he's never seen any of Charlie Chaplin's stuff, and I haven't seen very much of it. And so the other night we put on like a, it was on YouTube, like an 8-minute short with Charlie Chaplin. Okay. It's black and white. There's no sound, folks. Mm-hmm. And Charlie's doing this tightrope walk. Mm-hmm. And we're, you know, my wife and I are there and we're like, is he going to get it? Does it, you know, is it fun? Is it going to make any sense? And these little monkeys come on screen, real monkeys. And you think they're going to help him, but instead they're like pulling down his pants. So he's got like these boxers on, they're like on his head, their tails are getting in his mouth, and he is laughing so hard. And aww, it's amazing. Yeah. But that, you know, whatever, that's from like 80, 90. And it was interesting that the comedy worked. You see what I'm saying? It worked then and it worked now. And that's not true with everything, but I feel very similar with Shakespeare, where the stuff in it, the humanness, the relationships, the story, the comedy, it works now, which is really fantastic and so cool, right?
Absolutely. Well, and we see that too in a lot of carryovers where it's like, okay, so Lion King is Hamlet and, you know, She's the Man is Twelfth Night. And we kind of see the same stories being recycled. But it's also his poetry that's so, it like hits us on a cellular level. And whenever I'm working with someone on a piece, I'm like, I just don't understand Shakespeare. I'm like, well, let's read it out loud. You know, Shakespeare needs to be read out loud. It does not need to be read silently. It's poetry. It's music. It's like, I always like to say, like giving someone a Shakespeare piece or a play and say, hey, go in the corner and read this to yourself. It's like giving someone a piece of sheet music who doesn't know how to read music and say, go enjoy listening to this song, but you can't sing it out loud. Like, how are they supposed to enjoy it? You know? Yeah. So when students are like, I don't understand it, I'll say, read it out loud. And they read it out loud and they're like, oh, I'm like, what do you think it means? And like 99.9% of the time, they're like, oh, it's this. And you can see it like sink into their body. Oh, that's what they're saying. Like, yeah, you don't have to understand every single mythological reference. Now, as an actor, of course, you need to do the research and understand what that means. But as the audience doesn't need to understand every mythological reference or historical reference to understand the deeper meaning, because like Cody said, it's the human condition. Mm-hmm. It's something we can all relate to.
Mm-hmm. So what's the intro Shakespeare text for you, Alex? If someone's like, I don't know, there's so many, I've heard kind of some of them. What do you think is the step into the shallow water?
I love Macbeth. I just think it's, you know, it's a short play. I want to say it's his shortest play. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't feel quite so overwhelming when you pick it up. Mm-hmm. And it really has everything. And it's like sexual and freaky. And there's these weird women and there's violence and there's fights. And I don't know. I feel like there's something for everyone in that show. It's a good one. It's a good one.
Do you recommend people do, like, if you wanted to kind of test out, like, Shakespeare in the Park, or like something that you can kind of go watch and kind of see very quickly, like where do you go to find your Shakespeare intro, like if you're going to watch experience?
Yeah, I think when Shakespeare is done well, it's life-changing, and when Shakespeare is done poorly, it's awful. So I think you have to be careful. Try to go to a reputable company or a company that you know does good text work. But National Theater, Globe, like all those big, you know, British theater companies, they have digital streaming services online that you can watch. That I think is a great place to start too.
Yeah, I love. It's funny you mentioned. I did a summer program a long time ago, Alex, at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts.
Oh yeah.
And I can't remember who the Shakespeare teacher was there, but that was my first experience with it, like in my like late 20s. And it was so cool when it started to come to life, because it was a really good teacher. I think that's so helpful because it can be a little daunting. And then you have a teacher and you start to like, it starts to make sense, starts to come to life. The rhythm makes sense. So even if you yourself are not, you know, an expert in it, you know, like you said, you can kind of figure some things out, but then it's nice to have someone who can help guide you. I think that's so helpful. So you don't get frustrated. And then it really opens up, you know, it really starts to open up. Yeah.
Absolutely. Oh, and I also want to add a little caveat. I was like, go to a place that's reputable. There are plenty of like 99 seat theater companies that do great Shakespeare, you know, and do beautiful productions. Just if you go see a production and you don't like it, that doesn't mean that Shakespeare isn't for you. Sometimes you just got to keep looking until you find like the right company who does the work that you enjoy.
Yeah. Alex, did you do a show at the Center Theater Group?
I did.
Yeah. How was that experience, or, you know, doing theater around Los Angeles? I mean,
this one, but It was great. I mean, it was interesting because COVID had just hit. And so rather than doing it with an audience, we ended up doing this hybrid, you know, we were on stage, but then there was a film crew. And so it was also shot kind of like a movie. Like we had, you know, like close-ups and, you know, master shots. And so it wasn't like they just planted a camera in the, you know, seventh row and we just did it. So we had done the show earlier at another space. And so we got to have that experience of having the audience. But then when we transferred to the Douglas Drew Center Theater Group, it was completely different. And it was odd because we all had it was like being on a film set during COVID. We all had like the shields and the masks on, but we're on stage and then we had to take it off before we filmed and then touch up the makeup. So, you know, it's always great when you can be in a theater that has the level of resources that Center Theater Group has. Yeah. But it's also really fun to do the shows where there's like bring your own wardrobe and and everyone who's in the audience is like someone you know. Yes. Or there's more of you on stage than there are people in the audience. But yeah, Center Theater Group itself is a beautiful, beautiful experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. You know, I'm a big fan of theater. I find, you know, Alex, I'm just curious do you enjoy kind of working with like the same directors again and again? Do you like to work with new people? How do you kind of, you know, suss that out?
Yeah. I know this is going to be such a horrible answer, but both, like I enjoy both. Yeah. There's something really lovely about working with the same director multiple times because, you know their shorthand, you understand their vision, but also they know you. And so they can kind of hold you to the standard of work that they've seen you do. Mm-hmm. So there can be a little bit more transparency there sometimes in terms of, I know you can do better or whatever. Yeah. Not that like they would say it that way, but you know what I mean? Like, it's like when an athlete's been working with the same coach for a long time, like that coach knows their strengths, their weaknesses, their habits. But there's also something really lovely too about working with a director for the first time and seeing their vision and seeing how their brain works. And I always love the first day of rehearsal and just seeing how rehearsal space is set up. Whitney White, who directed the first version of the show, ended up going on the show that ended up going to Center Theater Group. That first rehearsal day, she had photos just all over the rehearsal space and just things she had printed out from online that were her inspirations for the show. And she encouraged people to continue to add to that wall as we went. Oh, cool. And I loved that. And then I've had other directors who don't believe in table work. And so we just jump right in because they think that the choices that actors make in table work or that first table read, which are often uninformed choices, that they tend to stick to those choices because those feel safe. Mm-hmm. So like that director doesn't believe in table reads. It's just straight into blocking. So I do love that too. Seeing the kind of the inner workings of a new director's mind. They're both equally lovely. I'm just always happy to work.
Yes. Yeah. But I think with what you're saying, and that's a great, you know, a compliment to you as an actor. I mean, that you've done that, but I think it's important for actors to know that not all directors come at it the same way. And as actors, you know, we can have our process, but we also have to be open to, oh, this is different than we did it last time, or this is not exactly, you know, how I would do it or whatever. And kind of having that openness can always be interesting. You know, because every director kind of approaches it differently, like you're saying. I think that's really interesting.
Absolutely.
Alex, we mentioned writing. Are you writing anything right now? Have you written stuff in the past? What's kind of your interest in that?
Yeah. So I'm working on a solo show right now about growing up in the South. So, and there's a book that's going to go along with it. That's more narrative, and more prose versus performance. So I've been working on this show for so long, and so long, y'all. It's embarrassing how long I have been working on this show and taken on many forms and iterations. And, but I will say I started working on it. Let me back up. It was one of those things where when I would tell people stories about growing up in the South, they were like, you have to turn this into something. These stories are wild. And so then I met this amazing woman named Terry Silverman, who helps. She's a creative coach and she works with actors and she has a class specifically for solo work. And so I started working with her. And the most amazing thing happened, which is like halfway through her class, I started booking a ton. And I credit all that booking to her, because there was something about kind of excavating my own life and forcing myself to be creative in a way that was different than what I was used to, that just kind of unlocked some other part of my acting that hadn't been there. So I say I've been working on this for a long time, but I also love the fact that it hasn't like ended, because I do feel like it fuels my acting in a very specific way.
Yeah, I always think it's interesting, like at Q&As, and I know people are curious, but you know, like Rocky was written supposedly like in a week, but then another movie's written in 10 years. And everyone's always like, oh, like so fast or so long. Like it's all, it's like, but it's so, like you're saying, I think certain things are very personal and they take the path they're going to take. And just because it took a long time to write doesn't mean it's going to be good. Just because it did it a short time doesn't mean it's going to be bad. You know, like it's really an interesting, especially with writing, you know, that can be really challenging. That can be really not always a linear path, right?
Absolutely. And it's had many different, you know, I've done readings and performances and things like that. And it just keeps wanting to morph. And so I think there's something to be said about creating for the act of creating versus I have to create this thing and sell it, or, you know, I have to create this thing and get an agent from it. Why not just have a project that you're constantly or consistently working on? You know, one of the reasons why Cody and I started our podcast was during COVID. There was this, I think we all felt this immense desire, especially at the top. Like, I want to be working. I want to be acting. I want to be creating. And, you know, theaters were shut down and sets were shutting down. And I had this moment of like, man, I've always wanted to work on this character. It was like, I could just work on it. Like, no one is stopping me from just reading that play and prepping for it like I would if I had that first rehearsal in 2 weeks. And so then that then became the start of our podcast, which is, what if we got actors of diverse backgrounds and we said, you have 2 weeks to prep Juliet and you have 2 weeks to prep Juliet. Don't talk to each other about your prep, but in 2 weeks, we're going to get together and we're going to hear how your Juliets are the same and how they're different and what inspired you about the character. And I've tried to maintain that habit. It's an easy one to lose because we're so used to going, well, I have to do this because I want the job, versus what if I just create this thing and no one's really going to see it, but I'm getting to do the thing I love and put something out in the world that's separate from me. And I think there's great benefit to that.
It reminds you of like why you started doing this in the first place. Cause oftentimes you start to be, like I said, like it becomes a job. So you're like, I want to get it right. And sometimes you can get messy and get it wrong. That's okay.
Yeah, why not? Or like go do a form of art that has absolutely nothing to do with your own art. I found this, and now I'm going to forget what it's called. I always forget what it's called, but it's like the Cabinet Makers or the Craftsman's Journal or something. It's a guy who is like a wood craftsman, and it's his journal of his projects. And I have found it to be so inspiring. The way he talks about creating a kitchen cabinet, I'm like, oh, that's what we do with characters. Like, I think there's a lot that we can learn from other artistic disciplines that we can apply to our own work.
I like that too, because it's interesting how stuff kind of gets unlocked in us that's not always logical. So even you saying you were taking that, like, you know, one woman, you know, or the show about you creating your own show, but then that helped unlock some of your auditions, and then doing something like this can inspire this. And I think that's a really allowing ourselves, man, kind of an awareness to absorb and be affected by different, you know, art or books or words or journals or, you know, things like that can kind of manifest itself in different ways, you know, if we allow that, right? So that given that space, I think that's really great.
Yeah, not to be cheesy, but it's almost like you talking made me go, how can we make, this is going to sound so corny, but how can we make our own creative soil like as fertile as possible? And that, I think, means consuming other forms of art, participating in other forms of art, and also just like being out in the world, like not forgetting that like we're also people, and in order to reflect life, we have to be a part of it too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's like I've been enjoying the comedian Nate Bargatze, and I listen, like, his stuff feels very normal, but he's really observant and he's really simple. But I think that really works. I mean, obviously he's been doing it for a long time, but what I mean is it doesn't feel like he's reinventing the wheel. And sometimes we feel like, well, I got to find that secret technique or that special sauce, and kind of what you're saying with the fertile soil. But it almost can sometimes be a little bit of a simplifying. And so we don't have to be doing all these things. It's just like, no, take that time, take that day, spend the time on the audition, do it a couple times, send it off, and then forget about it. You know what I mean?
Totally. And I found too, like, the more I'm just, and it's, I went through this phase where I was like, man, when I'm not preparing a ton, I'm booking more. And I talked to Cameron Watson about it because I was like, I feel lazy and I don't know why. Like, shouldn't I be booking less if I'm not preparing? And Cameron reminded me, he was like, but you've been preparing for this your whole life. You've been, you know, you've constantly been in training, and don't negate that. And also sometimes the more we prep, the more we're putting distance between us and the character versus going, like you said, simplifying. I can just hear it all the time. Like, I can just bring myself and trust that that's enough. One other tiny little thing I'll say is the other thing I do with coaching is I coach witnesses for trials and depositions using theater techniques. They don't know I'm an actor most of the time, but it's about helping them share their story and craft their stories. And it's funny because Cody is starting to do the work too. And she sat in on a few of my sessions and watched some recordings I had. And she asked me, she came downstairs and she goes, I have a question about the sessions. And I was like, yeah, what's up? And she was like, do you think you're a better actor? And I misinterpreted what she asked. I thought she meant like a better actor than a witness prep coach. And I was like, probably. Like, I probably am. And then she was like, no, I mean, like, do you think the witness prep has made you a better actor? And I was like, 100%, 100%, because it's getting back to like the basics of storytelling and just human connection and empathy and listening and holding space for these people as they monologue about the most traumatic thing that's ever happened in their life. And now they have to go to court over it. You know, I was like, it absolutely has made me a better actor. But we joke about that all the time. Do you think you're a better actor? I probably am a better actor than a witness. Now that's what I'm asking you, you weirdo.
Oh my god, that's funny. I love it. Well, Alex, this has been amazing. Like, I just love all of this. I love hearing your stories and what you've done and your philosophy and approach. I feel very connected to what you're saying, really. Like, a lot of that is kind of what I believe about the, you know, learning different acting techniques, use which ones, you know, work for you, all those things. So I think it's great. I'm really appreciative of it. We have a really fun segment that we like to kind of end the show with. Corbin, you want to tell her what it is?
It's called Your Best Bad
Acting. So we know you're a good actress, Alex, but we're going to send you a fun quote.
Sure.
And the idea is you get to perform it as like kind of a bad actor over the top, and then we might give you a fun redirect. I think I already know what I'm going to give her for a redirect, so okay, I shouldn't even do this, but I've already. So just give us one because I have something fun that I want to
hear. All right, can I pull it up?
Yes, it should be in the chat. Yes. Yes. And then once you read it.
All right, I'm just going to go. Nobody ever believed me when I'm telling the truth. I guess it's the curse of being a devastatingly beautiful woman.
Good. That's so good. This is Blanche from Golden Girls, everybody. I love it. I love it. For those that remember the show. Okay, I got to hear that Mississippi accent. That's what I got to hear.
Okay, y'all. All right, here we go. Nobody ever believed me when I feel now like I can't even do my own outfit. Let me try this again. Right. Nobody ever believed me when I'm telling the truth. I guess it's the curse of being a devastatingly beautiful woman.
Yes.
Oh, it's like, God, why can't I do my Southern accent all the time?
How's it? Where did it go?
My family will be so mad.
I heard it.
This is going to be a tough one, but I think I want to hear some doths and some Shakespearean words just thrown in there. Oh. That's going to be tough. I know it's not easy.
Yes.
Nobody doth believes when I telleth the truth.
Tell it.
Perchance it's the curse of being a devastatingly beautiful creature. I mean, that was
cool. No, that was so good.
Like, there's not really a lot of places for doth in there.
No, there really isn't.
No, when I telleth. Telleth
was the best.
There's that improv group that like improvises Shakespeare, and they do like Agatha Christie. I mean, they do a bunch of different genres. I have not seen them, but I've just heard that they're awesome, which is such a cool, fun world to explore. And I mean, yeah. And I think we did have somebody on, Aaron, who, you know, it's like, it's pretty much, it's really hard to improvise Shakespeare if you're in a Shakespeare show. But Corbin, didn't we have someone who said there was an older actress that would like improvise it? And they'd be like, those aren't the words. But like they got through and the audience wouldn't even, yeah, they were like.
I think I know. Is it an LA-based Shakespearean actress?
I think so. Yes.
I know exactly who you're talking about because I worked with her. And
yes, she's able to get, it was just crazy. I was like, that doesn't seem possible. But like somehow she's.
No, I worked with her on a show. And I'm not going to say her name. Once we stop recording, I'll be like, is it this person? But I worked with her on a show, and I won't say which show, but it's, you know, she's an older actress and she's, you know, a genius, a Shakespearean genius, but she's older. And so she's, you know, like memory and memorizing lines is difficult.
Yeah.
And she was doing this mammoth part that is normally a male role and she took it on. I mean, and it's just like, and the only reason why I say that is because obviously most of Shakespeare's, the characters with the most lines were men other than Rosalind, but she had like a ton of lines. Anyway, her partner on stage would always say to us, like, I never know when she's done talking and has forgotten the rest of the line or when she's just taking a dramatic pause, I never know. And so he was on stage with her one night. And it was one of the moments where she had this big pause and he was like, is she pausing for dramatic effect or is she done? And she's just forgotten the rest. And she looked at you, doth thou have anything to say to me? He's like, oh, okay. Okay. I'll say my line now. That's not my cue.
Oh my God. You know what's so funny about that, Alex? Yeah. A buddy of mine, he did a play with an older actor and the older actor always messed up a part. But the thing was, and he would prepare for that part, then he'd always mess up a different part. So he never would screw up the same part. So it was always changing every night. And he said that was really challenging. At least if it was one part, you could try to fix it, but it was always
something different.
Something different. Yeah, yeah.
So. Yeah, and this actress, not only can she improvise Shakespeare, but she can improvise in iambic pentameter, which wild. And that's part of the reason why the audience never catches on is because the audience is kind of lulled into this rhythm and she would just fall into the rhythm and brilliant.
Wow. Oh, well, Alex, this has been great. So lovely. Love the best bad acting. That was great. That was great. House on fire. That's my new phrase, Corbin. We're going to call this podcast on fire. thank you for joining us, Alex. This has been lovely. We really, really appreciate it. So thank you for coming by. Enjoy the rest of your day. Have a great one.
Bye bye.
Thank you for listening to the
Moon and Fox Life podcast.